Good morning and welcome to the third and final day of our November term, which is being held here on the campus of Dakota Wesleyan and Mitchell. We have several publications available for those of you who are attending, which you might find interesting. The first one is a gray covered booklet that tells you a little bit about ourselves and also a little bit about the 9 oral argument cases we will be considering this term. The second publication, which is available, is the one with our photograph on the cover, and it's a brief photographic history of the court system all the way back to the beginning of the Dakota territorial days. And the final publication is a blue covered book that's a written narrative on how the South Dakota Supreme Court and the judicial system in this state functions. These are available in the lobby without cost if you'd like to have a copy of them. We'd like to welcome this morning students from Lake Preston High School, Tripp Delmont High School, Butte, Nebraska High School, Rutland High School, Mount Vernon High School, Word of Life Academy, Catalano Family Home School, and Mitchell Technical Institute. The first case for oral argument this morning, I probably need a little help with this, is that we've been debating this in the back room, by the way. Is it Ravidites, or how do you pronounce this? Ravitz, okay. State versus Ravitz, Hanson, and Nicholson. For the appellant, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Gary Campbell, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre, and for the appellee, Ms. Lynn Moran, an attorney from Custer. Mr. Campbell, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity to present the state's case here. For the benefit of the audience, I'd just like to point out that this is an intermediate appeal in which the state is the appellant rather than the normal criminal case where the state's the appellee.
Welcome to the other side.
Well, it's a bit strange. It's better to react than to go first.
Maybe for the benefit of the audience, we should point out that if a person is acquitted, there cannot be an appeal. That's the end of the proceedings, and that's why it is unusual for the state to come in as the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. And another point is that there has been no trial and conviction in this case as of yet, because what the state is appealing is an intermediate order before trial suppressing evidence which was found pursuant to a search warrant. Now, the trial court here, Judge Thomas Trimble, found that a search warrant that had been signed by the Honorable Circuit Court Judge Janine Kern was lacking in any corroboration or showing of reliability of the anonymous tips on which it was largely based. Now, the state disagrees with that on two grounds. Number one, the state believes that there was adequate corroboration, there was probable cause demonstrated in the affidavit to support the search warrant. And in the second place, that if there was an invalidity in the warrant, that under the good faith exception of U.S. v. Leon, the evidence should be admissible anyway because the officer is entitled to good faith reliance on a search warrant issued by a judge.
Did Judge Trimble ever address the good faith issue in his findings?
He did not in his findings of fact and conclusions of law. The state submitted objections to, I think, the defense's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, and he wrote on the top of that denied. So he did have the opportunity to rule on it, and he overruled the state's objections. That's necessary, I think, to preserve the matter for appeal.
But you did present it.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You raised it then.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Are you saying that you did raise good faith?
Yes.
In the written objections?
Right. And that's the copy of the objections is attached in the appendix to, I think, both briefs, the state's brief and the defense's brief. Now, the way this case began was on July 6, 2003, an anonymous phone call came in at 8 in the morning to Custer County Deputy James Beschoivel. Now, a caller reported illegal drug activity at Ravetz's apartment. The male subject refused to be identified but stated he had information on suspicious activity that he believed related to narcotics trafficking. He stated he currently lived in the Winchester apartment building, gave the address, stated that a young lady who knows only as Kelly lived on the upstairs portion of the building and had a lot of traffic in and out of her apartment. He stated the traffic will be passing by on the street and Kelly will whistle at them from her front window. The vehicles will stop, people will go to her apartment for a short period ranging from 5 to 15 minutes and then will leave. He stated that Kelly is up at all times of the day and night. He even observed her at three in the morning looking out her window for traffic. As he left that day, and this is again 3 in the morning, a car drove past, Kelly whistled at it, and the car stopped. The driver, who he described as being a young female with blonde, Driver of the car walked upstairs to the apartment and left a few minutes later with something small and plastic clutched in her hand. The caller stated there are usually two females at the window and does not know the second female, he only knows Kelly. He gave the officer a list of license plates that he observed in the past few days at the apartment. He stated there were more vehicles at the house, but he could not always read the license plate. Now, looking at that by itself, maybe there isn't enough probable cause. Again, it's an anonymous tip, so that's subject to a certain amount of question. There has to be some corroboration. But one of the things that goes to the reliability and the credibility of an anonymous statement like this is that, according to the caller, this is based on firsthand observation. He is seeing the license plates. He's seeing the people. He's hearing Kelly whistle. He sees the women in the window, waving at the cars or whatever. It's not a case like Belmontes where the affidavit was based on essentially hearsay on top of hearsay. In that case, you had an informant telling another informant who tells the officer. Here you have it direct from a person observing the events in train. Now, all that's well and good. I don't think that establishes necessarily probable cause up to that point. But
we don't know anything at all about this informant, do we? Except that the person claims to live in the same apartment as Kelly, right?
Pretty much.
I mean, we don't know a thing about them, whether they're reliable in the past or anything.
You don't know about their background, whether there's anything nefarious in the background which would, impeach.
And what's a little bit scary about that is it could be somebody who's got a personal grudge match going with this Kelly or whatever, is just trying to get even, or maybe wants to get her evicted from the apartment or something because he claims she's creating too much traffic or something.
Well, that's possible. But then again, if you're a tenant in an apartment house, I remember from property law, first year of law school, your rights end at my nose. Well, that's kind of trite. But here, another tenant in the apartment has a right to a peaceful enjoyment of his property. You don't need to have people whistling at 3 in the morning. You don't have to have a thundering herd of people coming up to buy drugs all at any time of day or night. Another thing that puts this into perspective is that when the deputy checked the ownership of the vehicles that the license plates related to, that he had been given by the caller, no less than 3 of those came back to people who were related or known by the police, or at least suspected by the police, to be involved in the drug trade. The first one was Joseph Reginelli. He'd been arrested for possession of marijuana in the past and had recently been identified.
Now remind me, did the police actually see those vehicles on the premises?
No.
This is still hearsay.
Well, yes. But then again, probable cause, I believe, can be based on hearsay. Now, Reginelli was identified through drug debriefs and interviews to be dealing a large amount of marijuana in the Custer area. And Beshoy will put in his affidavit, I'm also aware Reginelli was identified in an interview conducted by the South Dakota Department of Criminal Investigation of receiving large amounts of marijuana from a person arrested by DCI earlier this year. Second license plate came back to another man who in June of 2003, this same deputy had contacted because of a report that he was selling marijuana to juveniles in the Custer area. He met with the man at his residence, found a marijuana pipe in the residence as a result of a consent search, and the man provided him with the name of a drug dealer in Hill City that he'd gotten his marijuana from. So that's two people here that the state, through independent sources, knew were involved in the drug trade that corresponded to the owners of the cars that the caller had seen. Third license plate came back to a woman who was the wife of a man that the same deputy, Deputy Bescheuvel, had arrested in the past for marijuana violations. Now, there were rumors, according to Bescheuvel in his affidavit, there were rumors that were unsubstantiated that both of them were involved in trafficking in illegal narcotics. But the fact still remains, the deputy had personal experience of this woman's husband and drugs. There are apparently several other license plates that didn't turn up any information that was significant. Now, 2 hours after Bescheuvel got that first call, a second anonymous call comes in. Now, whether these two people are related or living together or working together, we don't know, but it seems quite possible.
Do we really even know if it wasn't the same person?
Well, I think they were probably different because the deputy in the affidavit regarding the first caller always says he. Regarding the second caller, he says he or she. He wasn't sure of the sex of the second caller. That's at least what I gather. So from the face of the affidavit, it looks like these are two different calls.
The second caller didn't indicate that person lived in the apartment building either, did they?
Excuse me, I didn't.
Did the second caller indicate they lived in the apartment building? I don't think so.
Just a moment. The second caller doesn't mention being a resident there, but does mention several times having smelled the odor of burnt or burning marijuana coming from that apartment. So it's someone who is familiar with the premises.
Remind me again how large apartment complex this is. How many apartments are in it? Or is there anything in the record that indicates?
I don't think there's anything in the record that really describes it in any great detail, but the apartment, which is, to my understanding, is on the third floor, is number 9. So it looks as if it's a relatively, seems to me that it's a relatively small apartment house. Maybe it's, you know, 2 or 3 apartments on each floor.
So there was there any attempt by the officers to go to the neighbors and make any inquiry?
Not that I know of. I believe that the officer wasn't able to identify them, but I don't know to what extent he checked.
Was there any connection between the first caller and the second caller? I mean, it seems quite coincidental that within hours, a second caller calls on the same subject matter.
Well, there's nothing directly linking them. I think, you know, they might be associated with each other, they might not be. They might just be two different tenants that are both fed up with the thundering herd of people going up to Kelly's apartment. I don't know.
Wouldn't have that been a valid inquiry for the officer to determine whether or not it's a grudge match or people are ganging up on somebody to get them out of the apartment or something?
Well, I think if he was able to find that information, it might have been helpful. But I don't know that he was under an obligation to do so if, you know, he does in fact not know who these people are.
The second one would not give their name either?
Right. The second person declined to be identified. Now, that second caller, again, refused to identify himself, herself, as the officer puts in the affidavit, but stated that he or she had information regarding the Kelly Joy Rivettes. Caller stated there have been a lot of foot and vehicle traffic in the apartment owned by Kelly since Wednesday of that week. Now, the calls were coming in, I think, on a Sunday morning. So Wednesday would be a few days earlier, but you're not talking about a great stretch of time here.
Now, did the callers, when they called, were they indicating that the activity was going on as they were reporting it, or that it had happened in the past?
That it had happened.
Okay.
Now, it had happened in the recent past, but it's...
When they called in the middle of the night?
No, they called 8 o'clock on Sunday morning and 10 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Okay.
So they weren't calling in the middle of the night, although apparently a lot of the activity was going on in the middle of the night. I think you could, you know, you could infer from the way from the information they gave that it was going on pretty recently. Now that call went on to say, and this is interesting, it says said that he or she was a former narcotics user and recognized the pattern of drug deals taking place based on his or her previous experience. It stated that on Wednesday of this week, he or she observed a male subject he knows to be Joseph Reginelli, he or she knows, arrive at Kelly's apartment. He or she knew that Reginelli to have sold marijuana in the past and believed him still to be doing so. Caller stated Reginelli stayed a few minutes before leaving. Immediately after he left, vehicles started showing up at Kelly's apartment, staying for less than 20 minutes for each visit. He or she stated that he or she counted 5 vehicles that came and went from the apartment immediately after Reginelli's visit. He or she also stated that he/she recognized the smell of burning or burnt marijuana from his or her previous experiences, and that he or she occasionally smells the odor coming from Kelly's apartment. Now, that kind of thing, I think, combined with the first call and combined with the officer's verification that this Reginelli character and at least 2 other people that are involved in the drug trade, I think that pushes this up to the level of probable cause. Now, level probable cause is not evidence that's sufficient to convict. It's simply evidence that basically the probable cause is based on whether there's a substantial basis for the issuing judge's finding of probable cause. The inquiry for this court is whether the information provided the judge was sufficient for a common sense decision that there was a fair probability the evidence would be found on the persons or at the place to be searched. Furthermore, we review the issuing judge's probable cause decision to grant a search warrant independently of the conclusion reached by the circuit court in the suppression hearing. Reviewing courts, now this is from State v. Jackson. Reviewing courts are not empowered to conduct an after-the-fact de novo probable cause determination. On the contrary, the issuing judge's legal basis for granting the warrant is examined with great deference. And that's going back to Gates and again as quoted in Jackson. Deferential standard of review is appropriate to further the Fourth Amendment's strong preference for searches conducted pursuant to a warrant. And informant's reliability, veracity, and basis of knowledge are relevant considerations, but not independent essential elements. Now here you do have some indication of veracity in that the callers are referring to this Rivets, and Rivets tracks back to that license plate, which the first caller reported to the deputy.
But wouldn't the second caller, I think it's the second caller that identifies him, he or she, as a former narcotics user?
Yes.
Wouldn't that almost raise a red flag? I mean,
actually,
I think that it would seem to me that the officer getting that kind of a call would think in terms of why would another user be turning in a fellow...
Well, it's someone who's a former user. And I think if you're a former user, you have very good reason not to be living right next door or on the floor below an ongoing drug trafficking operation. Now, if you're on parole or on probation on drug charges, you could really get yourself in trouble if if the police think you're associating with drug traffickers. I don't think that, that aspect of it necessarily cuts against these informants. And the informant was honest enough to admit that, which I think should count in their favor. It's not like they're brushing things over and pretending to be, you know, angels. They're not.
Would also help to establish that that the person recognized the smell of burnt marijuana and so forth, right?
And also the pattern of people coming and going immediately after this Reginelli arrives. To a certain extent, it gives the basis for their knowledge of why these things are suspicious. Just like, as you say, it points out the basis for the second caller's recognizing the smell of marijuana.
Now, who actually talked to these callers, these anonymous callers? Did the police officer who did the search prepared the affidavit?
It was the deputy.
So some of these are a result, probably some of this information is a result of the officer asking specific questions?
That I don't know. I imagine some of it would be. Now, given this record, and given the great deference that is shown to the judge's decision, this would be Judge Kern, not Judge Trimble, who signed the search warrant, I think that this does arise to the level of probable cause, and I think the search warrant was valid. I think what Judge Trimble did was essentially did a de novo review, which is not the proper procedure in this situation. So I'm asking this court, on the basis of this, to find that probable cause existed and that the search warrant was valid and that evidence seized pursuant to that warrant is admissible. Now, if the probable cause determination was wrong on the part of Judge Kern, the state still maintains that this evidence is admissible under the good faith exception in Leon, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, was adopted by this court in State v. Saez back in 1988. I think here...
Your time has expired, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Moran, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. The defendants in this case do not have a lot of issue with the facts as stated by the state. However, of course, we have quite a different idea about whether or not this rises to the level of a substantial basis for the issuance of this search warrant. First of all, it's our position that there was insufficient probable cause in this search warrant, which was applied for by Deputy Bischoffel in Custer County. First of all, the two anonymous calls that were used. First of all, there were conclusions in the first anonymous call. They concluded or suspected that there was drug activity because there was a lot of activity at this, and they keep referring to Kelly's apartment. However, it must be remembered that this is an apartment building. That there are more than one apartments in this apartment building, and we know that there are at least eight others because the search warrant was presented for apartment number 9. The anonymous caller said that they only knew Kelly as by her first name. They said that they resided in the same apartment building, the Winchester Apartments, but nowhere did the information come forward whether or not they lived next door, whether or not they lived on the same floor, anything to suggest that they had what their point of their vantage point was. You know, what's the basis of their knowledge? The anonymous caller gave license plate numbers to Deputy Bischoffel, several license plate numbers, three of which Deputy Bischoffel recognized as belonging to persons that he had knowledge of that were involved in drug activity. First of all, he mentions Joseph Reginelli, and frankly, anyone who was familiar with the court system would have knowledge that that person was involved in drug activities. He also indicated that he recognized Zane Abraham, but that from his personal information or his personal knowledge, he knew Zane Abraham was involved in drug activities. Then he recognized the name of Shanda Carter, as a wife of a person he knew was, had been arrested regarding marijuana. The deputy actually points out in his affidavit that the rumors about the Carters were not substantiated. As a matter of fact, he indicated that they were unsubstantiated. So in effect, you have two license plates numbers that match up with persons that the deputy recognized as being involved in some drug activity in Custer County. The first anonymous caller at 8 o'clock in the morning also said that at one point in time, one day, and he doesn't say what day, that he saw Kelly at 3 o'clock in the morning as he was leaving, and that she was at the window and whistled to someone, apparently in the window waiting for some activity. That's another conclusion that this anonymous caller indicated. He also indicated that he saw young woman respond to that whistle, come to Kelly's apartment, and then leave with something plastic in her hand. Doesn't say if it's a plastic bag, a plastic box, what. Again, the basis of knowledge has to be questioned here, because first of all, if he's observing Kelly at a window and sees her whistle at someone to come into the apartment building, how does he then see this person leave if he in fact was also leaving? It seems to me that he is confusing his vantage points there. He's either in the parking lot watching her whistle at the street traffic, or else he's in the building watching her go in and come out with something in her hand. What this affidavit and this anonymous caller doesn't say, again, is the basis of knowledge. How, if he were leaving, could he see Kelly call someone in from her window, then see that person go out? You have to remember again that Kelly is one apartment in that apartment building. Was he in his car leaving? Was he in the hallway watching? How could he be both places at once? There were no questions asked by Deputy Bishoval that would answer these questions for us. There was so much unanswered information that it's almost like it was an intentional omission, or certainly a disregard for the truth of the matter. The only verification or corroboration that Deputy Bishoval conducted was the verification of these license plates number. He did not leave his office. The second phone call came in 2 hours later. You know, as luck would have it, another anonymous phone call regarding Kelly Ravitz. Now, this person indicated he knew Kelly's last name. It was a he or a she. That was never verified. The information that the second anonymous caller gave was the last name of Kelly. He indicated that he had observed activity at this location. And then this additional information that the second anonymous caller gave was that he or she saw Joe Reginelli come to Kelly's apartment. Again, we don't know how he saw that, whether or not he or she was a resident of that apartment building, whether or not it was a friend who concocted this story with the first anonymous caller. Also, when the second anonymous caller indicated that he was a former drug user, he or she was a former drug user, and that he recognized the smell of burnt marijuana, and that occasionally he or she had smelled that coming from Kelly's apartment. Nothing in the record in regard, or nothing given to the deputy about when that smelling of marijuana was. Was Kelly Ravitz in the apartment when the marijuana was smelled? Again, no point of reference as to how this basis of knowledge was accumulated.
Counsel,
mm-hmm.
you seem to be judging the affidavit in support of the search warrant by those questions that aren't answered, instead of looking at it for the questions that were answered. And you do recognize that obtaining a search warrant is a much preferable practice under our Constitution than just going out on exigent circumstances or performing a search and seizure without a search warrant, don't you?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. The only thing is that this ends up being a bare bones affidavit because of the things that were missing. All we have in the affidavit is the information that Deputy Bishoval got from two anonymous phone calls.
So now, you think that Circuit Court Judge Janine Kern, who approve the search warrant in support of an approve the affidavit in support of the search warrant, just absolutely made a mistake?
I believe that the judge was misled, first of all, by the information, and secondly, it just doesn't, I think that the probable cause was not shown for this reason. These are anonymous phone calls, and it's clear that when information is given by an anonymous tipster, that has to still be verified. One has to look at what the basis of knowledge is, and whether or not there is personal knowledge of the defendants, and whether or not there's any additional research before this anonymous information can be given any credibility.
Okay, now, but give me your definition of probable cause.
Well, there has to be a substantial basis established in the affidavit. And I don't think that you can conclude that there was a substantial basis.
No, but that's the definition of what's required in order to get a search warrant. But what's your definition of probable cause that there is something that should be searched?
Okay, it's not unlike what the state had indicated. It's, of course...
A fair probability?
Correct.
Would you also say that it's if it's more probable than not, or mathematically, if it's 51% that there is a crime being committed, would you accept that?
Well, I don't know that I would go to the percentages. Is it, if it's 20% correct, is that sufficient? If it's 51%, is that sufficient? You have to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Okay, I understand that, mm-hmm. but would you agree with the words, if it's more probable than not, that's sufficient for probable cause?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay.
And I don't think that was established in this case.
Okay, but now, looking at the evidence that was before Jeanine Kern in approving the search warrant, isn't it more probable than not that crimes were being committed in that apartment?
No, because the information was given by anonymous information informants whose credibility could not be established from the information that the deputies had. He had no information whatsoever or no knowledge of the reputation of the defendants. He had no personal observation. What the deputy could have certainly done at the very least was go to that residence to see, in fact, is there a window of Kelly Ravitt's apartment that opens onto the street? You know, in fact, did any of these vehicles, were they in the area at that time? In fact, was there a lot of activity? He didn't put this apartment building under surveillance. He didn't do anything but sit in his office and verify three license plates, or verified five or six license plates, three of whom he recognized.
Now, in fairness to you, you got an opportunity to make these arguments to Judge Trimble, but not to Judge Kern, right?
Correct.
Okay, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So that there was no corroboration of this anonymous information. All the other cases cited in both the state's brief and in the our brief, there's so much more information presented in the affidavits that could, where there would be at least more probability shown that illicit activity was being committed.
Ms. Moran, most of the cases that have been decided on this anonymous tipster factual scenario, most of the time involve one person and some corroboration. What significance should this court give to the fact that the second caller, in effect, corroborated many of the details that were related by the first caller? Isn't that corroboration in and of itself?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. And for this very reason, I agree with Justice Meyer, Henry, that this would throw up a red flag. This suggests to me more of a situation where there's corroboration between the two of, or collaboration between the two of these anonymous tipsters in order to get Kelly Ravitz in trouble. That can be just as, that probably, to me, seems to be a more likely scenario, that these two people called because they somehow discussed this matter with each other.
Well, if we follow that line of logic, then if there had been a third caller 2 hours later, then following your logic, it would even be less likely that it's the truth. if there would have been a fourth caller saying the same thing, it would have been even more unlikely.
Well,
so your logic suggests that the more information you have, the more unlikely it is to be true.
Well,
that doesn't seem to me to be common sense.
That's not what my logic suggests, in all deference to you, Justice Inter. The fact of the matter is we had two anonymous phone calls here, and there isn't anything in this second anonymous phone call that was actually verified by Deputy Bishoval. As you read his affidavit, you can tell that he doesn't go into any corroboration whatsoever in regard to the second anonymous phone call. What he did in regard to the first phone call was make to verify those license plates. Even the state suggests in their brief that there's a Montana case that suggests that verifying license plates alone would not rise to the level of establishing probable cause. So he didn't leave his office. He did not make an attempt to verify the veracity of the credibility, the reliability of his information. And yet he said to Judge Kern, when he presented his affidavit and application for search warrant, that this was credible evidence, that this was reliable evidence. The fact
that you stated earlier that not only this is a bare bones affidavit, but you said Judge Kern was actually misled. How was she misled?
Because, first of all, Deputy Bishoval indicated that this was reliable information. However, he didn't do anything but verify license plates, and it is reasonable to presume that he questioned very limited questioning of the people he was getting this information from. There was so much more he could have asked, only he wouldn't want to because it might not coincide with being able to establish the veracity of these anonymous tipsters.
Can you point to any specific fact in there, the affidavit that's misleading?
Excuse me?
Can you point to any specific fact in that affidavit that's misleading?
That he said that it was credible evidence.
That's a conclusion.
That is a conclusion, yes.
You can point to no facts alleged in there that are misleading.
But the facts...
Can you answer the question?
Pardon me?
Are there facts in there that are misleading?
There are facts that he listed that he didn't verify, and so in that instance, I believe it's misleading to the court.
Did he say he verified them?
Well, he called it credible or reliable evidence, so that suggests he corroborated it, and checking the license plates isn't sufficient corroboration. Our position is that. The
Before you run out of time, could we go to the good faith issue?
Sure.
You know, as you know, even if a search warrant is invalid, the United States Supreme Court has said that if the police officer acts in good faith in executing the warrant, the search is still considered valid. Why wouldn't that apply here?
It wouldn't apply here for two reasons. Of course, in the Leon case, which was adopted by this court in Saez, the four reasons where the good faith would not apply. I believe two of those are pertinent in this case, and as I mentioned before, I believe that the issuing magistrate was misled by the disregard for the truth that Deputy Bishoval had in the application process. Again, there was so much information he could have presented and didn't, and he didn't get out of his office in order to corroborate this evidence.
But if a judge, if he presents this to a judge and the judge tells him, this is sufficient, I'm going to go ahead and issue the warrant, why is it bad faith for him to believe her, she's a trained judge, experienced judge, and go out and execute the warrant?
Well, Justice Konenkamp, as you know from the record here, Deputy Bishoval was the one who prepared the warrant. It's hard to then to turn around and say, oh, I have to rely on this. I relied on this on good faith. He was the one who not only executed the warrant, but prepared the warrant. And it was his information, his insufficient information, that was in that affidavit. He couldn't then, in our opinion, indicate that he was acting in good faith.
Did Judge Trimble address this? Was this argument made before him? I see there's nothing in his written findings about good faith.
That's right. Your Honor, this is a cold record as the state has made reference to it, and so it was. Judge Trimble had the benefit of the preliminary hearings, and he had the benefit of the memorandum of law that the counsel submitted, and then made specific findings based on that. to proceed with why I believe that the exception to the exclusionary rule would not be applied in this case. In our opinion, there's no indicia of reliability upon which the officer could reasonably act. He was the officer who prepared the affidavit and also the officer that executed the warrant. When he received these anonymous phone calls, they went directly to him on a Sunday. Supposedly there had been this activity from Wednesday on. Again, that's another red flag. They called Deputy Bisseville directly, 2 hours apart, and the license plate number that he recognized, one of which he had to and actually did say in his affidavit that their rumored drug involvement was only rumored, it was not substantiated.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. As pointed out in Belmont, which we believe is the controlling case here, every citizen is entitled, and I'm paraphrasing, to be secure from the possibility that angry neighbors or ex-lovers or whatever will provide anonymous information leading to police intrusion. And I think that is particularly the case here. The good faith exception does not apply. In Belmont, it indicated that an officer who does not merely execute but prepares and submits a warrant application containing misstatements and omissions cannot rely on the acceptance of that application as evidence that his conduct was objectionably reasonable. We believe that Belmont is controlling and the trial court should be affirmed. This is a bare bones affidavit. The officer applying and the officer executing was the same person. He knew he had inadequate and insufficient probable cause, and any reasonably well-trained officer would have also known. Unless there's any other questions.
I just have one.
Sure.
Would you agree that at the end of the day, we're going to have to decide simply whether there's a common sense, fair probability that there was drug activity going on in this apartment?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Moran.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. In listening to the defendant's arguments, we hear, well, the officer was misleading the judge. The officer, through omission or fabrication, is misleading the judge. There's nothing at all in the record to support these accusations. This is all trumped up. I think if you look at what the officer had to work with, as reflected in the affidavit, there is probable cause. If there's not probable cause, it's a near-run thing, and Leon should apply. Now, the defense says there are intentional omissions. Where? Says it's a bare-bones affidavit. That's not true either. A bare-bones affidavit, and this is comes down from the U.S. Supreme Court, is something where an officer says in the affidavit that based on good reason to believe that this evidence will be found at this place, I request a search warrant. That's bare bones. Here you do not have a bare bones affidavit because you have the basis for the anonymous tipster's knowledge. You have their observations, their sight, their smell, the smell of marijuana. You have corroboration through the license tags which track back to drug use and drug trafficking. This is far from, the facts of this case are actually far from what the defendant is trying to portray, the defendants, plural. I think Belmontes is determinative, and it's determinative in the sense that none of what the defense is saying happened. Belmontes was an odd case. That's the one with the anonymous tipster telling another tipster who tells an officer, and none of this is put in the affidavit. In this case, where there's shady areas, the officer put it in. He put in that the one tipster had admitted to being a prior drug user. He puts in that there were just that the regarding the man and wife license plate, that while he had I think, arrested the husband. There were only unsubstantiated rumors. This is not an officer who is hiding the facts. This is an officer who is being honest. And I think that Judge Kern was justified in issuing that warrant, and the deputy was justified in relying on that warrant. Under that, whether there's probable cause or not, Leon should apply. If there's probable cause, you don't need to proceed to Leon. On that, I'll basically close my argument unless there are additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.